This is Audible.
Highbridge Audio presents A River Runs Through It and Other Stories by Norman MacLean. Read for you by David Manis. A River Runs Through It. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John, the favorite, was a dry fly fisherman. It is true that one day a week was given over wholly to religion. On Sunday mornings, my brother Paul and I went to Sunday school, and then to morning services to hear our father preach, and in the evenings to Christian Endeavor, and afterwards to evening services to hear our father preach again. In between, on Sunday afternoons, we had to study the Westminster Shorter Catechism for an hour, and then recite before we could walk the hills with him while he unwound between services. But he never asked us more than the first question in the catechism: what is the chief end of man? And we answered together so one of us could carry on if the other forgot. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. This always seemed to satisfy him, as indeed such a beautiful answer should have. And besides, he was anxious to be on the hills, where he could restore his soul and be filled again to overflowing for the evening sermon. His chief way of recharging himself was to recite to us from the sermon that was coming, enriched here and there with selections from the most successful passages of his morning sermon. Even so, in a typical week of our childhood, Paul and I probably received as many hours of instruction in fly fishing as we did in all other spiritual matters. After my brother and I became good fishermen, we realized that our father was not a great fly caster. But he was accurate and stylish, and wore a glove on his casting hand. As he buttoned his glove in preparation to giving us a lesson, he would say, "It is an art that is performed on a four-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock. As a Scot and a Presbyterian, my father believed that man by nature was a mess, and had fallen from an original state of grace. Somehow I early developed the notion that he had done this by falling from a tree. As for my father, I never knew whether he believed God was a mathematician, but he certainly believed God could count, and that only by picking up God's rhythms were we able to regain power and beauty. Unlike many Presbyterians, he often used the word beautiful. After he buttoned his glove, he would hold his rod straight out in front of him, where it trembled with the beating of his heart. Although it was 8.5 feet long, it weighed only 4.5 ounces. It was made of split bamboo cane from the far-off Bay of Tonkin. It was wrapped with red and blue silk thread, and the wrappings were carefully spaced to make the delicate rod powerful, but not so stiff it could not tremble. Always it was to be called a rod. If someone called it a pole, my father looked at him as a sergeant in the United States Marines would look at a recruit who had just called a rifle a gun. My brother and I would have preferred to start learning how to fish by going out and catching a few, omitting entirely anything difficult or technical in the way of preparation that would take away from the fun. But it wasn't by way of fun that we were introduced to our father's art. If our father had had his say, nobody who did not know how to fish would be allowed to disgrace a fish by catching him. So you, too, will have to approach the art Marine and Presbyterian style. And if you have never picked up a fly rod before, you will soon find it factually and theologically true that man by nature is a damn mess. The 4.5-ounce thing in silk wrappings that trembles with the underskin motions of the flesh becomes a stick without brains, refusing anything simple that is wanted of it. All that a rod has to do is lift the line, the leader and the fly off the water, give them a good toss over the head, and then shoot them forward so they will land in the water without a splash in the following order: fly, transparent leader, and then the line. Otherwise, the fish will see the fly as a fake and be gone. Of course, there are special casts that anyone could predict would be difficult, and they require artistry. Casts where the line can't go over the fisherman's head because cliffs or trees are immediately behind. Sideways casts to get the fly under overhanging willows and so on. But what's remarkable about just a straight cast? Just picking up a rod with line on it and tossing the line across the river? Well, until man is redeemed, he will always take a fly rod too far back. Just as natural man always overswings with an axe or golf club and loses all his power somewhere in the air. Only with a rod it's worse, because the fly often comes so far back it gets caught behind in a bush or rock. When my father said it was an art that ended at 2 o'clock, he often added, "closer to 12 than to 2, meaning that the rod should be taken back only slightly farther than overhead, straight overhead being 12 o'clock. Then, since it is natural for man to try to attain power without recovering grace, he whips the line back and forth, making it whistle each way, and sometimes even snapping off the fly from the leader. But the power that was going to transport the little fly across the river somehow gets diverted into building a bird's nest of line, leader, and fly that falls out of the air into the water about 10 feet in front of the fisherman. If, though, he pictures the round trip of the line, transparent leader, and fly, from the time they leave the water until their return, they're easier to cast. They naturally come off the water heavy line first and in front, and light transparent leader and fly trailing behind. But as they pass overhead, they have to have a little beat of time, so the light transparent leader and fly can catch up to the heavy line, now starting forward, and fall again behind it. Otherwise, the line starting on its return trip will collide with the leader and fly still on their way up, and the mess will be the bird's nest that splashes into the water 10 feet in front of the fisherman. Almost the moment, however, that the forward order of line, leader, and fly is reestablished, it has to be reversed, because the fly and transparent leader must be ahead of the heavy line when they settle on the water. If what the fish sees is highly visible line, what the fisherman will see are departing black darts, and he might as well start for the next hole. High overhead, then, on the forward cast, at about 10 o'clock, the fisherman checks again. The four-count rhythm, of course, is functional. The one-count takes the line, leader, and fly off the water. The two-count tosses them seemingly straight into the sky. The three-count was my father's way of saying that at the top, the leader and fly have to be given a little beat of time to get behind the line as it's starting forward. The four-count means put on the power and throw the line into the rod until you reach 10 o'clock. Then check cast. Let the fly and leader get ahead of the line and coast to a soft and perfect landing. Power comes not from power everywhere, but from knowing where to put it on. Remember, as my father kept saying, it is an art that is performed on a four-count rhythm between 10 and 2 o'clock. My father was very sure about certain matters pertaining to the universe. To him, all good things, trout as well as eternal salvation, come by grace, and grace comes by art, and art does not come easy. So my brother and I learned to cast Presbyterian style on a metronome. It was Mother's metronome, which Father had taken from the top of the piano in town. She would occasionally peer down to the dock from the front porch of the cabin, wondering nervously whether her metronome could float if it had to. When she became so overwrought that she thumped down the dock to reclaim it, my father would clap out the four-count rhythm with his cupped hands. Eventually, he introduced us to literature on the subject. He tried always to say something stylish as he buttoned the glove on his casting hand. "Isaac Walton," he told us when my brother was 13 or 14, "is not a respectable writer. He was an Episcopalian and a bait fisherman." Although Paul was 3 years younger than I was, he was already far ahead of me in anything relating to fishing, and it was he who first found a copy of The Complete Angler and reported back to me, "Bastard doesn't even know how to spell complete. Besides, he has songs to sing to dairymaids." I borrowed his copy and reported back to him, "Some of those songs are pretty good." He said, "Whoever saw a dairymaid on the Big Blackfoot River?" "I would like," he said, "to get him for a day's fishing on the Big Blackfoot, with a bet on the side." The boy was very angry, and there has never been a doubt in my mind that the boy would have taken the Episcopalian money. When you're in your teens, maybe throughout your life, being 3 years older than your brother often makes you feel he is a boy. However, I knew already that he was going to be a master with a rod. He had those extra things besides fine training. Genius, luck, and plenty of self-confidence. Even at this age, he liked to bet on himself against anybody who would fish with him, including me, his older brother. It was sometimes funny, and sometimes not so funny, to see a boy always wanting to bet on himself and almost sure to win. Although I was 3 years older, I did not yet feel old enough to bet. Betting, I assumed, was for men who wore straw hats on the backs of their heads. So I was confused and embarrassed the first couple of times he asked me if I didn't want a small bet on the side just to make things interesting. Third time he asked must have made me angry because he never again spoke to me about money, not even about borrowing a few dollars when he was having real money problems. We had to be very careful in dealing with each other. I often thought of him as a boy, but I could never treat him that way. He was never my kid brother. He was a master of an art. He did not want any big brother advice or money or help, and in the end, I could not help him, since one of the earliest things brothers try to find out is how they differ from each other. One of the things I remember longest about Paul is this business about his liking to bet. He would go to county fairs to pretend that he was betting on the horses like the men, except that no betting booths would take his bets because they were too small and he was too young. When his bets were refused, he would say, as he said of Isaac Walton and any other he took as a rival, "I'd like to get that bastard on the Blackfoot for a day with a bet on the side." By the time he was in his early 20s, he was in the big stud poker games. Circumstances, too, helped to widen our differences. The draft of World War I immediately left the woods short of men. So at 15, I started working for the United States Forest Service. And for many summers afterwards, I worked in the woods, either with the Forest Service or in logging camps. I liked the woods, and I liked work. But for a good many summers, I didn't do much fishing. Paul was too young to swing an axe or pull a saw all day. And besides, he had decided this early he had two major purposes in life: to fish and not to work, at least not allow work to interfere with fishing. In his teens, then, he got a summer job as a lifeguard at the municipal swimming pool. So in the early evenings, he could go fishing, and during the days, he could look over girls in bathing suits and date them up for the late evenings. When it came to choosing a profession, he became a reporter on a Montana paper. Early then, he had come close to realizing life's purposes, which did not conflict in his mind from those given in answer to the first question in the Westminster Catechism. Undoubtedly, our differences would not have seemed so great if we had not been such a close family. Painted on one side of our Sunday school wall were the words, "God is love." We always assumed that these three words were spoken directly to the four of us in our family and had no reference to the world outside, which my brother and I soon discovered was full of bastards, the number increasing rapidly the further one gets from Missoula, Montana. We also held in common the knowledge that we were tough. This knowledge increased with age, at least until we were well into our 20s and probably longer, possibly much longer. But our differences showed even in our toughness. I was tough by being the product of tough establishments, the United States Forest Service and logging camps. Paul was tough by thinking he was tougher than any establishment. My mother and I watched, horrified, morning after morning, while the Scottish minister tried to make his small child eat oatmeal. My father was also horrified, at first because a child of his own bowels would not eat God's oats. And as the days went by, because his wee child proved tougher than he was. As the minister raged, the child bowed his head over the food and folded his hands as if his father were saying grace. The child gave only one sign of his own great anger. His lips became swollen. The hotter my father got, the colder the porridge, till finally my father burned out. Each of us then not only thought he was tough, he knew the other one had the same opinion of himself. Paul knew that I'd already been foreman of forest fire crews, and that if he worked for me and drank on the job, as he did when he was reporting, I would tell him to go to camp, get his time slip, and keep on down the trail. I knew that there was about as much chance of his fighting fire as of his eating oatmeal. We held in common one major theory about street fighting. If it looks like a fight is coming, get in the first punch. We both thought that most bastards aren't so tough as they talk, even bastards who look as well as talk tough. If suddenly they feel a few teeth loose, they will rub their mouths, look at the blood on their hands, and offer to buy a drink for the house. But even if they still feel like fighting, as my brother said, you're one big punch ahead when the fight starts. There's just one trouble with this theory. It is only statistically true. Every once in a while you run into some guy who likes to fight as much as you do and is better at it. You start off by loosening a few of his teeth, he may try to kill you. I suppose it was inevitable that my brother and I would get into one big fight, which also would be the last one. When it came, given our theories about street fighting, it was like the battle hymn, terrible and swift. There are parts of it I did not see. I did not see our mother walk between us to try to stop us. She was short and wore glasses and, even with them on, did not have good vision. She had never seen a fight before or had any notion of how bad you can get hurt by becoming mixed up in one. Evidently, she just walked between her sons. The first I saw of her was the gray top of her head, the hair tied in a big knot with a big comb in it. But what was most noticeable was that her head was so close to Paul I couldn't get a good punch at him. Then I didn't see her anymore. The fight seemed suddenly to stop itself. She was lying on the floor between us. And we both began to cry and fight in a rage, each one shouting, "You son of a bitch, you knocked my mother down!" She got off the floor and, blind without her glasses, staggered in circles between us, saying without recognizing which one she was addressing, "No, it wasn't you. I just slipped and fell." So this was the only time we ever fought. Perhaps we always wondered which of us was tougher, but if boyhood questions aren't answered before a certain point in time, they can't ever be raised again. So we returned to being gracious to each other, as the wall suggested that we should be. We also felt that the woods and rivers were gracious to us when we walked together beside them. It is true that we didn't often fish together anymore. We were both in our early 30s now, and now, from here on, is the summer of 1937. My father had retired, and he and mother were living in Missoula, our old hometown, and Paul was a reporter in Helena, the state capital. I had gone off and got married, to use my brother's description of this event in my life. At the moment, I was living with my wife's family in the little town of Wolf Creek. But since Wolf Creek is only 40 miles from Helena, we still saw each other from time to time, which meant, of course, fishing now and then together. In fact, the reason I'd come to Helena now was to see him about fishing. The fact also is that my mother-in-law had asked me to. I wasn't happy, but I was fairly sure my brother would finally say yes. He had never said plain no to me, and he loved my mother-in-law and my wife, whom he included in the sign on the wall, even though he could never understand what had come over me that would explain why marriage had ever crossed my mind. I ran into him in front of the Montana Club, which was built by rich gold miners, supposedly on the spot where gold was discovered in Last Chance Gulch. Although it was only 10 o'clock in the morning, I had a hunch he was about to buy a drink. I had news to give him before I could ask the question. After I gave him the news, my brother said, "He'll be just as welcome as a dose of clap." I said to my brother, "Go easy on him. He's my brother-in-law." My brother said, "I won't fish with him. He comes from the West Coast and he fishes with worms." I said, "Cut it out. You know he was born and brought up in Montana. He just works on the West Coast. And now he's coming back for vacation and writes his mother he wants to fish with us. With you, especially. My brother said, practically everybody on the West Coast was born in the Rocky Mountains, where they failed as fly fishermen. So they migrated to the West Coast and became lawyers, certified public accountants, presidents of airplane companies, gamblers, or Mormon missionaries. I wasn't sure he was about to buy a drink, but he had already had one. We stood looking at each other, not liking anything that was happening, but watching that we didn't go too far in disagreeing. Actually, though, we weren't very far apart about my brother-in-law. In some ways, I liked him even less than Paul did. And it's no pleasure to see your wife's face on somebody you don't like. Besides, my brother said, he's a bait fisherman. All those Montana boys on the West Coast sit around the bars at night and lie to each other about their frontier childhood, when they were hunters, trappers, and fly fishermen. But when they come back home, they don't even kiss their mothers on the front porch before they're in the back garden with a red Hills Brothers coffee can digging for angleworms. My brother and his editor wrote most of the Helena paper. The editor was one of the last small-town editors in the classic school of personal invective. He started drinking early in the morning so he wouldn't feel sorry for anyone during the day. He and my brother admired each other greatly. The rest of the town feared them, especially because they wrote well. And in a hostile world, both of them needed to be loved by their families, and were. I could tell by now that I was keeping my brother from buying a drink. And sure enough, he said, let's go in and hoist one. I made the mistake of sounding as if I were afraid to come out and criticize his morals. I said, I'm sorry, Paul, but it's too early in the morning for me to start drinking. Having to say something else quick, I didn't improve my morals, at least not in my own eyes, by adding, Florence asked me to ask you. I hated to pass the buck to my mother-in-law. One reason Paul and I loved her was that she looked like our father. Both of them were Scots by way of Canada. Both of them had blue eyes and sandy hair, which was red when they were younger. And both of them pronounced about the way Canadians do, who, if they were poets, would rhyme it with snoot. I couldn't feel too sorry, though, because it really was she who had put me up to asking. And she had begun confusing me by mixing a certain amount of truth with her flattery. Although I know nothing about fishing, she said, I know Paul is the best fisherman anywhere. This was a complicated statement. She knew how to clean fish when the men forgot to, and she knew how to cook them. And most important, she knew always to peer into the fisherman's basket and exclaim, my, my. So she knew all that any woman of her time knew about fishing. Although it is also true that she knew absolutely nothing about fishing. I would very much like to think of Neil with him and you, she concluded, no doubt hoping that we would improve his morals even more than his casting. In our town, Paul and I were known as the preacher's kids, and most mothers refrained from pointing us out to their children. But to this Scottish woman, we were the pastor's sons. And besides, as fly fishermen, we would be waist-deep in cold water all day, where immorality is faced with some real, but as it turned out, not insurmountable problems. Poor boy, she said, adding as many Scottish R's as she could to poor. More than most mothers, Scottish mothers have had to accustom themselves to migration and sin. And to them, all sons are prodigal and welcome home. Scotsmen, however, are much more reserved about welcoming returning male relatives, and do so largely under the powerful influence of their women. Sure I will, Paul said, if Florence wants me to. And I knew that, having been given his word, I would never get another kick from him. Let's have a drink, I said. And at 10:15 a.m., I paid for it. Just before 10:15, I told him Neil was coming to Wolf Creek day after tomorrow, and that the day following we were to go fishing on the Elkhorn. It's to be a family picnic, I told him. That's fine, he said. The Elkhorn is a small stream running into the Missouri, and Paul and I were big fish fishermen, looking with contempt upon the husbands of wives who have to say, oh, we like the little ones, they make the best eating. But the Elkhorn has many special features, including some giant brown trout that work their way up from the Missouri. Although the Elkhorn was our favorite small stream, Paul said, after paying for our second drink. I don't have to be on the beat tomorrow until evening. So what about just you and me taking the day off and fishing the big river before we have to go on the picnic? Paul and I fished a good many big rivers, but when one of us referred to the big river, the other knew it was the big Blackfoot. It isn't the biggest river we fished, but it is the most powerful, and per pound so are its fish. It runs straight and hard. On a map or from an airplane, it's almost a straight line running due west from its headwaters at Rogers Pass on the Continental Divide to Bonner, Montana, where it empties into the South Fork of the Clark Fork of the Columbia. It runs hard all the way. Near its headwaters on the Continental Divide, there is a mine with a thermometer that stopped at 69.7 degrees below zero, the lowest temperature ever officially recorded in the United States, Alaska omitted. From its headwaters to its mouth, it was manufactured by glaciers. The first 65 miles of it are smashed against the southern wall of its valley by glaciers that moved in from the north, scarifying the earth. Its lower 25 miles were made overnight, when the great glacial lake covering northwestern Montana and northern Idaho broke its ice dam and spread the remains of Montana and Idaho mountains over hundreds of miles of the plains of eastern Washington. It was the biggest flood in the world for which there is geological evidence. It was so vast a geological event that the mind of man could only conceive of it, but not prove it until photographs could be taken from Earth's satellites. The straight line on the map also suggests its glacial origins. It has no meandering valley, and its few farms are mostly on its southern tributaries, which were not ripped up by glaciers. Instead of opening into a wide floodplain near its mouth, the valley, which was cut overnight by a disappearing lake when the great ice dam melted, gets narrower and narrower, until the only way a river, an old logging railroad, and an automobile road can fit into it is for two of them to take to the mountainsides. It is a tough place for a trout to live. The river roars, and the water is too fast to let algae grow on the rocks for feed. So there's no fat on the fish, which must hold most trout records for high jumping. Besides, it's the river we knew best. My brother and I had fished the Big Blackfoot since nearly the beginning of the century, my father before then. We regarded it as a family river, as a part of us, and I surrender it now only with great reluctance to dude ranches, the unselected inhabitants of Great Falls, and the Moorish invaders from California. Early next morning, Paul picked me up in Wolf Creek, and we drove across Rogers Pass, where the thermometer is that stuck at 0.3 degrees short of 70 below. As usual, especially if it were early in the morning, we sat silently respectful until we passed the big divide, but started talking the moment we thought we were draining into another ocean. Paul nearly always had a story to tell in which he was the leading character, but not the hero. He told his Continental Divide stories in a seemingly light-hearted, slightly poetical mood, such as reporters often use in writing human interest stories. But if the mood were removed, his stories would appear as something about him that would not meet the approval of his family, and that I would probably find out about in time anyway. He also must have felt honor-bound to tell me that he lived other lives, even if he presented them to me as puzzles in the form of funny stories. Often I did not know what I had been told about him as we crossed the divide between our two worlds. "You know," he began, "it's been a couple of weeks since I fished the Blackfoot." At the beginning, his story sounded like factual reporting. He had fished alone, and the fishing had not been much good, so he had to fish until evening to get his limit. Since he was returning directly to Helena, he was driving up Nevada Creek along an old dirt road that followed section lines and turned at right angles at section corners. It was moonlight. He was tired and feeling in need of a friend to keep him awake, when suddenly a jackrabbit jumped onto the road and started running with the headlights. "I didn't push him too hard," he said, "because I didn't want to lose a friend." He drove, he said, with his head outside the window so he could feel close to the rabbit. With his head in the moonlight, his account took on poetic touches. The vague world of moonlight was pierced by the intense white triangle from the headlights. In the center of the penetrating isosceles was the jackrabbit, which, except for the length of his jumps, had become a snowshoe rabbit. The phosphorescent jackrabbit was doing his best to keep in the center of the isosceles, but was afraid he was losing ground. And when he looked back to check, his eyes shone with whites and blues gathered up from the universe. My brother said, "I don't know how to explain what happened next, but there was a right-angle turn in this section line road, and the rabbit saw it and I didn't." Later, he happened to mention that it cost him $175 to have his car fixed. And in 1937, you could almost get a car rebuilt for $175. Of course, he never mentioned that, although he did not drink when he fished, he always started drinking when he finished. I rode part of the way down the Blackfoot, wondering whether I'd been told a little human interest story with hard luck turned into humor, or whether I'd been told he had taken too many drinks and smashed hell out of the front end of his car. Since it was no great thing either way, I finally decided to forget it. And as you see, I didn't. I did, though, start thinking about the canyon where we were going to fish. The canyon above the old Clearwater Bridge is where the Blackfoot roars loudest. The backbone of a mountain would not break. So the mountain compresses the already powerful river into sound and spray before letting it pass. Here, of course, the road leaves the river. There was no place in the canyon for an Indian trail. Even in 1806, when Lewis left Clark to come up the Blackfoot, he skirted the canyon by a safe margin. It is no place for small fish or small fishermen. Even the roar adds power to the fish, or at least intimidates the fishermen. When we fished the canyon, we fished on the same side of it, for the simple reason that there is no place in the canyon to wade across. I could hear Paul start to pass me to get to the hole above, and when I realized I didn't hear him anymore, I knew he had stopped to watch me. Although I have never pretended to be a great fisherman, it was always important to me that I was a fisherman and looked like one, especially when fishing with my brother. Even before the silence continued, I knew that I wasn't looking like much of anything. Although I have a warm personal feeling for the canyon, it is not an ideal place for me to fish. It puts a premium upon being able to cast for distance. And yet, most of the time, there are cliffs or trees right behind the fisherman, so he has to keep all his line in front of him. It's like a baseball pitcher being deprived of his windup. And it forces the fly fisherman into what is called a roll cast, a hard cast that I have never mastered. The fisherman has to work enough line into his cast to get distance without throwing any line behind him, and then he has to develop enough power from a short arc to shoot it out across the water. He starts accumulating the extra amount of line for the long cast by retrieving his last cast so slowly that an unusual amount of line stays in the water, and what is out of it forms a slack semi-loop. The loop is enlarged by raising the casting arm straight up and cocking the wrist until it points to 130. There then is a lot of line in front of the fisherman, but it takes about everything he has to get it high in the air and out over the water so that the fly and leader settle ahead of the line. The arm is a piston, the wrist is a revolver that uncocks, and even the body gets behind the punch. Important, too, is the fact that the extra amount of line remaining in the water until the last moment gives a semi-solid bottom to the cast. It's a little like a rattlesnake striking, with a good piece of his tail on the ground as something to strike from. All this is easy for a rattlesnake, but has always been hard for me. Paul knew how I felt about my fishing and was careful not to seem superior by offering advice. But he had watched so long that he couldn't leave now without saying something. Finally, he said, "The fish are out farther." Probably fearing he had put a strain on family relations, he quickly added, "Just a little farther." I reeled in my line slowly, not looking behind so as not to see him. Maybe he was sorry he had spoken, but having said what he said, he had to say something more. "Instead of retrieving the line straight toward you, bring it in on a diagonal from the downstream side. The diagonal will give you a more resistant base to your loop so you can put more power into your forward cast and get a little more distance." Then he acted as if he hadn't said anything, and I acted as if I hadn't heard it. But as soon as he left, which was immediately, I started retrieving my line on a diagonal, and it helped. The moment I felt I was getting a little more distance, I ran for a fresh hole to make a fresh start in life. It was a beautiful stretch of water, either to a fisherman or a photographer, although each would have focused his equipment on a different point. It was a barely submerged waterfall. The reef of rock was about 2 feet under the water, so the whole river rose into one wave, shook itself into spray, then fell back on itself and turned blue. After it recovered from the shock, it came back to see how it had fallen. No fish could live out there where the river exploded into the colors and curves that would attract photographers. The fish were in that slow backwash, right in the dirty foam, with the dirt being one of the chief attractions. Part of the speckles would be pollen from pine trees, but most of the dirt was edible insect life that had not survived the waterfall. I studied the situation. Although maybe I had just added 3 feet to my roll cast, I still had to do a lot of thinking before casting to compensate for some of my other shortcomings. But I felt I had already made the right beginning. I had already figured out where the big fish would be and why. Then an odd thing happened. I saw him. A black back rose and sank in the foam. In fact, I imagined I saw spines on his dorsal fin until I said to myself, God, he couldn't be so big you could see his fins. I even added, you wouldn't even have seen the fish in all that foam if you hadn't first thought he would be there. But I couldn't shake the conviction that I had seen the black back of a big fish, because as someone often forced to think, I know that often I would not see a thing unless I thought of it first. Seeing the fish that I first thought would be there led me to wondering which way he would be pointing in the river. Remember, when you make the first cast, I thought, that you saw him in the backwash where the water is circling upstream. So he will be looking downstream, not upstream, as he would be if he were in the main current. I was led by association to the question of what fly I would cast, and to the conclusion that it had better be a large fly, a number 4 or 6, if I was going after the big hump in the foam. From the fly, I went to the other end of the cast and asked myself where the hell I was going to cast from. There were only gigantic rocks at this waterfall, so I picked one of the biggest, saw how I could crawl up it, and knew from that added height I would get added distance. But then I had to ask myself, how the hell am I going to land the fish if I hook him while I'm standing up there? So I had to pick a smaller rock, which would shorten my distance but would let me slide down it with a rod in my hand and a big fish on. I was gradually approaching the question all river fishermen should ask before they make the first cast. If I hook a big one, where the hell can I land him? One great thing about fly fishing is that after a while, nothing exists of the world but thoughts about fly fishing. It is also interesting that thoughts about fishing are often carried on in dialogue form, where hope and fear, or many times two fears, try to outweigh each other. One fear looked down the shoreline and said to me, a third person distinct from the two fears, there is nothing but rocks for 30 yards, but don't get scared and try to land him before you get all the way down to the first sandbar. The second fear said, it's 40, not 30 yards to the first sandbar, and the weather has been warm, and the fish's mouth will be soft, and he will work off the hook if you try to fight him 40 yards downriver. It's not good, but it'll be best to try to land him on a rock that's closer. The first fear said, there's a big rock in the river that you will have to take him past before you land him. But if you hold the line tight enough on him to keep him this side of the rock, you'll probably lose him. The second fear said, but if you let him get on the far side of the rock, the line will get caught under it and you'll be sure to lose him. That's how you know when you have thought too much. When you become a dialogue between you'll probably lose, and you're sure to lose. But I didn't entirely quit thinking, although I did switch subjects. It is not in the book, yet it is human enough to spend a moment before casting and trying to imagine what the fish is thinking. Even if one of its eggs is as big as its brain, and even if, when you swim underwater, it's hard to imagine that a fish has anything to think about. Still, I could never be talked into believing that all a fish knows is hunger and fear. I have tried to feel nothing but hunger and fear, and don't see how a fish could ever grow to 6 inches if that were all he ever felt. In fact, I go so far sometimes as to imagine that a fish thinks pretty thoughts. Before I made the cast, I imagined the fish with the black back lying cool in the carbonated water full of bubbles from the waterfalls. He was looking downriver and watching the foam with food in it, backing upstream like a floating cafeteria coming to wait on its customers. And he probably was imagining that the speckled foam was eggnog with nutmeg sprinkled on it. And when the whites of eggs separated and he saw what was on shore, he probably said to himself, "What a lucky son of a bitch I am that this guy and not his brother is about to fish this hole." I thought all these thoughts, and some besides, that proved of no value. And then I cast, and I caught him. I kept cool until I tried to take the hook out of his mouth. He was lying covered with sand on the little bar where I had landed him. His gills opened with his penultimate sighs. Then suddenly he stood up on his head in the sand and hit me with his tail, and the sand flew. Slowly at first my hands began to shake, and although I thought they made a miserable sight, I couldn't stop them. Finally, I managed to open the large blade to my knife, which several times slid off his skull before it went through his brain. Even when I bent him, he was way too long for my basket, so his tail stuck out. There were black spots on him that looked like crustaceans. He seemed oceanic, including barnacles. When I passed my brother at the next hole, I saw him study the tail and slowly remove his hat, and not out of respect to my prowess as a fisherman. I had a fish, so I sat down to watch a fisherman. He took his cigarettes and matches from his shirt pocket and put them in his hat, and pulled his hat down tight so it wouldn't leak. Then he unstrapped his fish basket and hung it on the edge of his shoulder where he could get rid of it quick should the water get too big for him. If he studied the situation, he didn't take any separate time to do it. He jumped off a rock into the swirl and swam for a chunk of cliff that had dropped into the river and parted it. He swam in his clothes with only his left arm. In his right hand, he held his rod high, and sometimes all I could see was the basket and the rod. And when the basket filled with water, sometimes all I could see was the rod. Currents smashed him into the chunk of cliff, and it must have hurt. But he had enough strength remaining in his left fingers to hang to a crevice, or he would have been swept into the blue below. Then he still had to climb to the top of the rock with his left fingers and his right elbow, which he used like a prospector's pick. When he finally stood on top, his clothes looked hydraulic, as if they were running off him. Once he quit wobbling, he shook himself, duck-dog fashion, with his feet spread apart, his body lowered, and his head flopping. Then he steadied himself and began to cast, and the whole world turned to water. Below him was the multitudinous river, and where the rock had parted it around him, big-grained vapor rose. The mini-molecules of water left in the wake of his line made momentary loops of gossamer, disappearing so rapidly into the rising big-grained vapor they had to be retained in memory to be visualized as loops. The spray emanating from him was finer-grained still and enclosed him in a halo of himself. The halo of himself was always there and always disappearing, as if he were candlelight flickering about 3 inches from himself. The images of himself and his line kept disappearing into the rising vapors of the river, which continually circled to the tops of the cliffs where, after becoming a wreath in the wind, they became rays of the sun. The river above and below his rock was all big rainbow water, and he would cast hard and low upstream, skimming the water with his fly but never letting it touch. Then he would pivot, reverse his line in a great oval above his head, and drive his line low and hard downstream, again skimming the water with his fly. He would complete this grand circle 4 or 5 times, creating an immensity of motion which culminated in nothing if you did not know even if you could not see, that now somewhere out there a small fly was washing itself on a wave. Shockingly, immensity would return as the big Blackfoot and the air above it became iridescent with the arched sides of a great rainbow. He called this shadow casting. And, frankly, I don't know whether to believe the theory behind it. That the fish are alerted by the shadows of flies passing over the water by the first casts, so hit the fly the moment it touches the water. It's more or less the working up an appetite theory. Almost too fancy to be true. But then, every fine fisherman has a few fancy stunts that work for him and for almost no one else. Shadow casting never worked for me, but maybe I never had the strength of arm and wrist to keep lines circling over the water until fish imagined a hatch of flies was out. My brother's wet clothes made it easy to see his strength. Most great casters I have known were big men, over 6 feet. The added height certainly making it easier to get more line in the air in a bigger arc. My brother was only 5'10", but he had fished so many years, his body had become partly shaped by his casting. He was 32 now, the height of his power, and he could put all his body and soul into a 4.5-ounce magic totem pole. Long ago, he had gone far beyond my father's wrist casting, although his right wrist was always so important that it had become larger than his left. His right arm, which our father had kept tied to the side to emphasize the wrist, shot out of his shirt as if it were engineered, and it, too, was larger than his left arm. His wet shirt bulged and came unbuttoned with his pivoting shoulders and hips. It was also not hard to see why he was a street fighter, especially since he was committed to getting in the first punch with his right hand. Rhythm was just as important as color, and just as complicated. It was one rhythm superimposed upon another, our father's four-count rhythm of the line and wrist being still the base rhythm. But superimposed upon it was the piston two-count of his arm, and the long overriding four-count of the completed figure eight of his reversed loop. The canyon was glorified by rhythms and colors. I heard voices behind me, and a man and his wife came down the trail, each carrying a rod, but probably they weren't going to do much fishing. Probably they intended nothing much more than to enjoy being out of doors with each other, and on the side to pick enough huckleberries for a pie. In those days there was little in the way of rugged sports clothes for women, and she was a big, rugged woman and wore regular men's bib overalls, and her motherly breasts bulged out of the bib. She was the first to see my brother pivoting on the top of his cliff. To her, he must have looked something like a trick rope artist at a rodeo, doing everything except jumping in and out of his loops. She kept watching while groping behind her to smooth out some pine needles to sit on. "My, my," she said. Her husband stopped and stood and said, "Jesus." Every now and then he said, "Jesus." Each time his wife nodded. She was one of America's mothers who never dream of using profanity themselves, but enjoy their husbands, and later come to need it like cigar smoke. I started to make for the next hole. "Oh, no," she said. "You're going to wait, aren't you, till he comes to shore so you can see his big fish?" "No," I answered. "I'd rather remember the molecules." She obviously thought I was crazy, so I added, "I'll see his fish later." And to make any sense for her, I had to add, "He's my brother." As I kept going, the middle of my back told me that I was being viewed from the rear both as quite a guy, because I was his brother, and also as a little bit nutty because I was molecular. Since our fish were big enough to deserve a few drinks and quite a bit of talk afterwards, we were late in getting back to Helena. On the way, Paul asked, "Why not stay overnight with me and go down to Wolf Creek in the morning?" He added that he himself had to be out for the evening, but would be back soon after midnight. I learned later it must have been around 2 o'clock in the morning when I heard the thing that was ringing, and I ascended through river mists and molecules until I awoke catching the telephone. The telephone had a voice in it which asked, "Are you Paul's brother?" I asked, "What's wrong?" The voice said, "I want you to see him." Thinking we had poor connections, I banged the phone.
"Who are you?" I asked. He said, "I am the desk sergeant who wants you to see your brother." The checkbook was still in my hand when I reached the jail. The desk sergeant frowned and said, "No, you don't have to post bond for him. He covers the police beat and has friends here. All you have to do is look at him and take him home." Then he added, "But he'll have to come back. The guy is going to sue him. Maybe two guys are." Not wanting to see him without a notion of what I might see, I kept repeating, "What's wrong?" When the desk sergeant thought it was time, he told me, "He hit a guy, and the guy is missing a couple of teeth and is all cut up." I asked, "What's the second guy suing him for?" "For breaking dishes, also a table," the sergeant said. "The second guy owns the restaurant. The guy who got hit lit on one of the tables." By now I was ready to see my brother, but it was becoming clear that the sergeant had called me to the station to have a talk. He said, "We're picking him up too much lately. He's drinking too much." I had already heard more than I wanted. Maybe one of our ultimate troubles was that I never wanted to hear too much about my brother. The sergeant finished what he had to say by finally telling me what he really wanted to say. "Besides, he's behind in the big stud poker game at Hot Springs. It's not healthy to be behind in the big game at Hot Springs. You and your brother think you're tough because you're street fighters. At Hot Springs, they don't play any child games like fist fighting. In Hot Springs, it's the big stud poker game and all that goes with it." I was confused from trying to rise suddenly from molecules of sleep to an understanding of what I did not want to understand. I said, "Let's begin again. Why is he here, and is he hurt?" The sergeant said, "He's not hurt, just sick. He drinks too much. At Hot Springs, they don't drink too much." I said to the sergeant, "Let's go on. Why is he here?" According to the sergeant's report to me, Paul and his girl had gone into Weiss's restaurant for a midnight sandwich, a popular place at midnight since it had booths in the rear where you and your girl could sit and draw the curtains. "The girl," the sergeant said, "was that half-breed Indian girl he goes with. You know the one," he added, as if to implicate me. Paul and his girl were evidently looking for an empty booth, when a guy in a booth they had passed stuck his head out of the curtain and yelled, "Wahoo!" Paul hit the head, separating the head from two teeth, and knocking the body back on the table, which overturned, cutting the guy and his girl with broken dishes. The sergeant said, "The guy said to me, 'Jesus, all I meant is that it's funny to go out with an Indian. It was just a joke.'" I said to the sergeant, "It's not very funny." And the sergeant said, "No, not very funny, but it's going to cost your brother a lot of money and time to get out of it. What really isn't funny is that he's behind in the game at Hot Springs. Can't you help him straighten out?" "I don't know what to do," I confessed to the sergeant. "I know what you mean," the sergeant confessed to me. Desk sergeants at this time were still Irish. "I have a young brother," he said. "He's a wonderful kid, but he's always in trouble. He's what we call Black Irish." "What do you do to help him?" I asked. After a long pause,